Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning. This is Andre Traversa with you. We are here at the Cosmic Citizen this fine morning in Chicago. And my partner, Paula Thompson, is with us this morning. How are you, Paula?
I'm great, Andre. It's a snowy morning here in Colorado, but good to be here. It must be Saturday if it's Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen.
That is correct. And you know what we're doing this morning? We are going global for the first time. I shouldn't say for the first time, because we've had people call in from Canada before, but for the first time, we are really going international. We are having an international guest this morning from England, of all places. In fact, next week, we're going to have another guest from England, too, so it's going to be 2 weeks of British fun here on the air. Today, our guest is Charlie Fox. Charlie Fox is the author of a book called Being Water. It is available in paperback at lulu.com. Charlie has been reading the Urantia book since 1997, and that was one of his tracks that you just heard there, opening the show. Charlie, what's the name of that? What was the name of that that cut we just heard?
Oh, the name of the song. The name of the song is How It Ends.
How It Turns?
How It Ends.
How It Ends.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
nice.
And just
it's about the transition of death, you know.
Hmm. Wow. You know, your book is called, as I said, it's called Being Water.
Being like water, yeah.
Being like water, I'm sorry. Yeah, being like water. Okay. Anyway, where did that title come from? What are you trying to get across in that?
I'm trying to get across that Christianity is, the gospel of Jesus, as in the Urantia book and the Bible, is really about adapting to the world rather than trying to control it. Because I feel that most people try and control other people and events rather than adapting to them, because their ego won't allow them to let go.
That sounds a little bit like Taoism.
I guess Taoism is quite an aspect of what Jesus taught, really, because adaptability isn't really, it's a universal concept.
Okay. Tell me, you said, you mentioned Christianity, and in your book you talk about Christianity as if you're talking about what true Christianity is.
Mm.
Now, some readers might object and say, well, the gospel of Jesus is not the same thing as Christianity. Were you trying to appeal to a Christian audience by saying, by equating the gospel with Christianity?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to say that personal Christianity is real Christianity, and Christianity in general isn't. Personal Christianity is the difference between organized religion and personal religion, right? If that answers your question.
Okay. Okay. You kind of have a lot of different things you do in your book. You've got chapters on various subjects. You talk about the crucifixion. You talk about you even have a chapter on the occult. You kind of get into a lot of different areas. I guess I'm not really sure where to you know, if someone were to read this, were you trying to kind of create a book that people could just read kind of randomly, no particular order? I mean, was it meant to be a series of daily sort of devotions or reflections? I mean, people don't have to read it in order to really get what you're saying, do they?
Not really, no. I mean, I understand what you mean. It's quite a strange format. There's no linear presentation. It doesn't really run other than it's categorized to a certain extent. I think what I was trying to do was explain almost in bullet points the history of my own experience, and everyone's experience can relate to someone else's experience. You know, we don't have unique experiences necessarily. And I feel that, you know, it's people can relate and connect these things up without there having to be a stream of consciousness necessarily running all the way through it. And linear books, spiritual books, are often very heavy and very difficult to understand. Or, frankly, they're very boring, and they take a lot of pages to make a single point which can be made very simply and very succinctly with a statement rather than an enormous descriptive passage.
So, in a way, it's like following a stream of consciousness, and hence the title, Being Like Water. You're just, it flows, it's a flowing of a sort. Would you say that's true?
I'd say that's true, and the statements in the book are a bit like giving people things to flow around in between. So your consciousness flows through these statements and around these statements, and that's how you relate to them, rather than being directed and someone telling you this is how it is. It's a series of suggestions and considerations and discussion points, you know, which I think are fundamental to spirituality and the gospel of Jesus, and understanding it and living it, more importantly.
Do you, in your book, you talk about the difference between personal Christianity and organized religion. Do you see any kind of role for organized religion in people's lives? I mean, there are people, I know there are some readers who have really been, your answer readers have really been hurt by the church, and they sure. I've noticed that people sometimes take a real anti-church position, but then there also are readers who deeply are involved in the church and really get a lot out of it. Do you see that the church can serve a legitimate function in people's lives, even if it's not, even as long as people don't confuse it with the kingdom of God?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a church guy myself. Don't get me wrong. I haven't always been. I've been in and out of churches for a long time, and I normally move on because of politics, which is normally, you know, people abusing their power structures, which happen whenever people are in organizations. You know, you get people's egos and clashes and things, and people don't necessarily do what they're meant to be doing. I think the highest form of Christian church is the cell church or home church, I think, because it tends to take away that power structure, and then it becomes just about a group of people supporting each other and helping each other live as Jesus taught us.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, we had a guest on our show some time back, and it was such a memorable show, I have to mention. It was Julia Dean, who wrote a book about why people, it's called Quitting Church, why so many people are leaving churches.
Okay.
And I thought it was, and I believe, frankly, the future of the church is going to be the small group. It's going to be the house church. It's going to be the home
Absolutely,
church.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it needs to be that way.
So long as we can worship in a meaningful way, you know, but obviously that's the tricky part, you know. I think, you know, groups of people tend to get, and the Urantia book, you know, has that great section on the value of organized religion versus the pitfalls of quote-unquote institutionalized religion.
Sure, yeah.
Make that distinction between organized and institutionalized. And, you know, institutionalization really kind of, you know, you talk about the big buildings and the hallowed halls, and, you know, that's what makes you think of something that's become now fossilized or crystallized, you know, and that's where you really fall into the trap with that. But as long as we can worship together in a meaningful way. You know, I think churches are fine if it, you know, so long as they don't get that institutionalized feeling to them, or you know, it has to be, it's just so crystallized. Everything is so crystallized. It just has to be a certain way, and there's no room to explore different techniques of worship, or, you know.
That's right. Yeah. A lot of it, I think, is down to tradition. I think tradition is a real enemy of spirituality in a lot of ways. I mean, because if you take a lot of world religions, a lot of people will cling to their religion because of tradition, and nothing to do with their actual spiritual contents because of what's been passed down to them, and that's very rigid in their lives.
Right.
And I think that happens in the church as well. But I think the point you make about institutional religion and organized religion is, yeah, it's very valid. It's a very important point.
Well, and I don't mean to split hairs here or nitpick, although.
Oh, you should.
Well, your answer book is very precise. I think,
yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Paula, I think, I don't remember the book using the word organized religion. I think what they're talking about is socialized religion. Socialized. I'm sorry?
You're right. You're
okay.
Correct.
So, yeah, that's socialized religion versus institutional, because there still is a role for socialized religion. And I think that's,
yeah.
You know, that's, but, you know, one of the things that you mentioned tradition. It's so interesting. I don't think tradition itself is bad as long as people aren't slaves to it. You know, if someone practices a tradition because they really like it and they do it of their own free will and they're not doing it out of a sense of obligation or duty or because they think they're supposed to, I think that's okay. I think that can be meaningful for people. I think it's when people become enslaved by it that it becomes a problem.
So I think when something becomes non-expandable, I think it's wrong, because I think everything needs, by the nature of truth, you know, experience truth. If you can't expand what you feel is truth beyond your own tradition, then you're in trouble. I think that's the point, you know. If someone beyond their own religion they were brought up with experiences something more, but they feel as though they can't fit that outside their own religion because of the rigidity of it, I think that's wrong, and I think that's non-socialized religion, you know.
Well, and you know, Jesus called what you were describing earlier as traditional barrenness.
Right. Okay. Yeah,
and I think that's, you know, that's really it. It's become so locked inside a box, and what you were just saying, it can no longer grow, it can no longer expand,
mm-hmm.
and it's just locked in. And you know, he said over and over again, "I've come to set the spiritual captives free."
Yeah.
Now, you know,
yeah, sure.
What was he talking about? You know, why is somebody a spiritual captive? Because their religious growth, their spirituality has been locked inside a box. It can't expand because, you know, and that traditional barrenness comes to play. We do it just because this is the way it's always been done.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean anything. Who knows what the original reason for doing it was? That's been long ago forgotten, you know. It's just we're doing it because this is the way it's always been done. So.
I know. We have to go onwards and upwards. We can't, you know, just go on a plateau with what we know already, because, you know, why learn otherwise? Why we can't spiritualize ourselves if we're not open to... We can't be open to everything. We can't be open to backward ideas, but we have to, you know, use the spirit of truth to discern what is good and what is bad.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe would you be willing to read a bit of a section of your book and just give us a flavor and... you know, something like maybe a favorite little passage?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, let me think. Actually, what I'd like to do is I'd like to read something which is peculiar to the U.S., which I wrote because I feel, following on from what I was talking about with Andre a few minutes ago, talking about spirituality and politics, it's a very contentious issue, and it's one which is very fundamental, I think. So I'd like to just excuse my bad reading over the radio. I'm not great at doing this, but okay. This is the passage I like to read. It goes: since the Republican movement in the U.S. is so strongly aligned with fundamental Christianity, the opposite democratic movement is then peopled by more liberal types who will not embrace the hyper-religious establishmentarianism of the Republicans, and so via the liberalism comes all the other philosophies. New Age, paganism, pseudo-Hinduism, Buddhism, Eastern religions, and the occult. Therefore, the risk is that church and state are so closely allied in one political party that all members of the other, by political definition, may be persuaded or forced onto other spiritual paths. This then proves that politics and religion cannot safely coexist, or rather should never be conjoined in this manner. The polarization of US society will never be solved until they are successfully seen as separate entities. One a group authority for the people, and one a personal matter of experience, as real religion is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I've got my own, my own political biases, which sometimes they come through on the air, but I don't try. I try to keep it. Occasionally they come out, but I try to not do that as often as I possibly can. But I think that in America we have the religious right and we also have the religious left, and there really shouldn't be either one, because the problem is that politics is almost inherently polarizing, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Answer Book tells us to not mix religion and politics, because it divides people, religion is something which should be bringing people together, not dividing them. And by the way, there's a place for that. I'm not saying there's no place for political discussion. There's no place for, and there's even a place for polarization. Sometimes polarization is a good thing, but I don't think that that's not going to bring us together as brothers and sisters.
No, absolutely not. I think people create a tradition out of being one or another. I think there's a fundamentalist tradition and a liberal tradition, which goes along with, this split in the US. And I haven't seen it anywhere else, really, in the world. It only exists in the USA, and it's a very peculiar thing. It's very polarized, the US, into these two camps. Having said that, I'm not an American. I always feel cheeky commenting on it. I've spent a bit of time in America, but that's probably why I recognize it, because it doesn't exist in the UK. And the UK is possibly the closest social model, I think, to the US, apart from maybe Canada.
Well, now we know there are countries who the religion is the authority.
Okay, yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, there are countries where religion rules. That is the politics. But I'm really intrigued by what you're saying, because you are not from this country and because you do have the benefit of an objective point of view. I've been somewhat alarmed myself by the polarization of America and this two camps issue, and I think it's gone. It has come to such an extreme where we're almost paralyzed now. We can't do anything, and it seems like every decision is elevated to the level of the sky will fall. So we can't do anything because, boy, if we do that, the sky will fall. But then we can't do that because the sky will fall if we do that,
So you can't move. You can't. You're static, right?
Right. We're paralyzed. We're in gridlock. We're deadlocked. We can do nothing. And, both sides are the division is so clear. And I find that alarming. That, to me, is not, If we were a family and our family had reached that level of a pathological division within our own family, I would say, well, that family is about to fall apart. That family is going to end in at the very best in divorce, and it's probably going to be very bitter and nasty. They refuse to see each other's point of view. They refuse to entertain each other's viewpoint at all. It's such a polarization. And I would say, when you get religion involved and you get the passions of religion involved, that can happen. That tends to happen. And so I absolutely agree that the separation of church and state is so important for that reason, because when you get religion involved, passions are really high. They're heightened. Go ahead, Julian.
Sorry. I think that's why it's so important to have a personal religion and not a group religion, really, because, group religion doesn't really if you can argue it doesn't actually exist, because every individual is different. Everyone relates to God in their own particular way, and so if you have it, I think you can have a group vision, but if you have a concrete group religion, it doesn't work, and it creates these horrible situations of being under this umbrella and not being able to move it again. It's and you can't expand past it.
Well, and I think that it's a question of balance, though, because as we were saying earlier, I think there's a place for socialized religion, but you want to make sure that the group dynamic is one that allows for individual flexibility, for freedom, in personal faith and personal spiritual expression. So you want to create a group dynamic that allows for that, so that you don't get into, like you said, a rigid authoritarian box.
Okay. I mean, that's
just had a comment on the board. That's a very interesting comment. Bro Dave says separation of church and state is an error. The UB warns not to remove God, and I think of course it does do that, but it also warns against a totalitarian religious state. And it says, very clearly in the end of the book, we no sooner got rid of the totalitarian religious control when we fell right into the secular scientific, godless thing. So, truly, it is striking balance. And that seems to be the most challenging thing for us humans to do. And I think that, you're absolutely right, Charlie. The religion, Jesus described it as the religion of personal spiritual experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
He said we'd never all see alike, that is not possible. We could have unity of purpose and destiny without having uniformity.
Yes. That's it. Exactly.
So, this is part of the reason why the revelation is so important, because it really does liberate people from this authoritarian paradigm, the religions of authority. One of my favorite discourses in the book is the second discourse on religion. I mean, because it is just absolutely amazing. Jesus lays it out. He lays it down. And he tells his apostle the difference between the religion of the spirit and the religions of authority.
Yeah.
And
it's a very important distinction. I think Brother Dave is, I've spoken to him a couple of times on the Truth Book. I think I've posted a couple of things to him. He's right in that sense, but I think people need to have the same vision. It needs to be the same vision when he says that church and state, should be the same, but I don't think the church part should be God and state, really, rather than church and state. I think that's the definition.
Very good. Very good distinction.
Well, and I think one of the things that people forget, though, when people hear about separation of church and state, they think of these theocracies, where the state, the church runs the state. And that's true. That's not good. We also don't want the state running the church either. So that's another,
No.
We don't want somebody, for example, the state saying to a religious institution, I'll give you a good example. Let's say that there's a religious institution who doesn't want women in the ministry. Now, you and I both know that that's not a good thing, that women should be in ministry just like men. Okay? Mm-hmm. But I don't think the state has the right to tell the church, well, you have to have women in ministry, because that would interfere with their religious freedom. So you've got to, there's got to be, that's why separation of church and state is so important, so that those spheres can be kept separate, so that the church can figure out their own, can evolve to that point where they can, but if it was forced on them by the state, that probably wouldn't work very well.
No, I don't think so. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. I was thinking about something else. Someone knocked on my door. I'm sorry.
You need to go answer it.
No. I don't need to answer it. Sorry, Andre. Can you repeat the last bit of what you said, please?
Oh, I was just saying that. I was saying that, we don't want the state to run the church either. And I was saying that let's take the example of women in ministry, That's a great idea. Women should be in ministry just like men, but the state doesn't have the right to force a church to, let's say a church is a conservative church and they don't want women in ministry. The state wouldn't have the right to force the church to change that their position. And for a couple of reasons. One is because it violates the separation of church and state. But the other thing is that, you know, that a church should get to a place where they evolve into that position, you know, so that it's done by evolution, not by revolution. You don't want the church to be forced to do something that they're not ready to do yet.
Yeah. I mean, God and state, if we talk about it in that kind of way, it is very, it's an interesting subject because where do people get their guidance, you know? I mean, that tradition is where the church comes into play. So if you remove church and you call it God and the state, then people will still look for leadership. They'll still look for menu way. They'll still look for prophets, and they'll still look for some kind of leadership, some kind of structure. So there's no real easy answer to it in kind of real terms. And yeah, I think you're right, Andre. It's about evolution, and perhaps we're evolving to that point within the study group. Because it's taking away from that power structure, and it's giving back the power to the individuals who are making up the church.
Well, and you know, there's no way that anybody can control what goes on in study groups. They're autonomous. They're in people's homes, and they're much more relaxed. And certainly the person who owns the home can kind of control the direction of the group, or whoever's facilitating the group, and you would hope that they wouldn't be authoritative and heavy-handed, and that they would allow the spirit to flow and everybody to have a chance to express what's in their thoughts and their hearts. And you know, but I've been to a lot of different study groups, and they're all different. Some of them are very intellectual. Some of them are much more, let's hold hands and pray together, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But at least, you know, you would have a choice, what suits you better. You know, I know a lot of people absolutely do not want to be a part of anybody praying with them. You know, it's like, oh, no, I don't want to pray in public with anybody, you know.
Really?
And I can understand their feeling about that.
Yeah,
they're not
comfortable
with it. They shouldn't be forced to do it, you know. And on the other hand, I know other people who pray very easily with others, very easily with a group, and have sublime experiences doing that. And they should be able to do that too. So that, to me, that's the beauty of autonomy, is that each group can kind of develop its own character and expression, and it's still going to be led by the leader, whoever is facilitating. But the problem I think that we get into is when we try to nullify or stifle another person's spiritual expression.
Yeah, that's a good point. Again, faith tradition can kind of get in the way of that, I think. People can judge other people for the way they express, and that's a difficult thing to deal with for some people. And then people become isolated. I know a lot of people who have become isolated from the traditional view of worshiping God because that is different, or they're on a different stage of the journey, and they've been not accepted, and it's driven them completely the other way.
Right.
I think we have to be careful, Charlie, as the Rancher Book readers, because we can become dogmatic in our own way as well. I mean, I've heard some of the Rancher Book readers who are so dogmatically against any kind of socialized religion. They think religion should be a purely private and solitary experience, that if people do want to pray with other people in a study group, they get upset about it. And I think we need to be careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, we don't go to the other extreme either.
It's always about maintaining the balance in between. It can be a difficult thing when we are, we're all human beings, and when human beings get together, we all make mistakes at the end of the day. I mean, that's the nature of learning, that's the nature of experience, you know, and that's what we learn from. And as spirituality and religion is a very inherent and very powerful force. I mean, it's right at the center of it, you know, this is what makes us live, this is our purpose, this is what we're driving towards, this is our truth.
Right.
It can be very fiery,
Hey, we have a caller, guys. Let's
see what this person.
Things that just help promote certain other avenues and shit, and get out there and you need something more than just something that's gonna deal with more than just local.
Hello.
Hello.
440, you're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen.
Oh, I was just listening. What do you guys, what's the topic?
Well, we're talking to Charlie Fox about his book, Being Like Water, and Matters of Spiritual Import. Do you want to just keep listening?
Yes, I was listening. While I was listening, me and my cousin was talking. I just logged on.
Okay, very good.
Okay, thanks.
You bet. Okay, guys, sorry about that. You never know. You never know.
I think we caught him in the middle of his phone call. Yeah.
that was an interesting experience there.
Yeah. And Ann likes to say, welcome to live radio, folks.
Yeah, sure. Hopefully he'll ring back. I'd like to hear what he has to say.
And speaking of callers, by the way, I just want to give out our number. It's 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. We're talking again with Charlie Fox, whose book is Being Like Water. Charlie, you know, you have a lot of interesting chapters in that book, a lot of different subjects. Like I said, you even have a chapter on the occult. Why did you put a chapter in there on the occult?
Well, we all have our journey, you know, and it takes us in different directions. That's one direction mine took me. Through, you know, I think a lot of human beings are in love with power, instant power, and power over the people and power over whatever gets them what they want instantly. And people like to be told that they're special and they have this power and they have power, or they like to think they can develop superpowers and shortcuts in life. And I think that the occult is one very good way of doing that. Although ultimately it's not a good way of doing that, because it just leads to your own destruction. But it's something I went through. If you want to ask me something more specific, that's my general view on the occult. It's not a good one.
Were you involved in occult practices before you found the Urantia book?
Not as such. I had a few friends who I used to speak about. I've always been very much a Jesus-led person, or a person who spoke to God, but my path, if you like, my ministry path, if I have one, which I hope I do, has been, one aspect of it has been dealing with people who are involved with the occult and dodgy kind of worship.
What do you think are some of the dangers, or maybe dangers is too strong of a word, but what do you think are some of the pitfalls that come from being involved in occult practices?
A lot of it is really about being groomed by something. It's about being groomed by or seduced by. I know that's a bit of a strong word, but it's really the only word. By processes which people use to gain themselves power, basically, and it's a dangerous thing, because it takes us away from our thought adjuster, and it makes our ego overblown and dominate, and therefore the side of us which is very material and very much wants our own ego to be in a superior position will gain ascendancy. I mean, it's purely really it's Luciferian in nature. People say about the occult, it's the hidden knowledge, and that can you know, it can categorize everything from things like Reiki to, you know, satanic worship, different kinds of black magic. I hesitate to kind of go any further into talking about that, really, because it's not something.
Most of the stuff that people get involved in when they call it cult doesn't go to that extreme. I mean, most of it is, you know, what they call white magic or Wicca, or maybe people get involved with, you know, psychic phenomena or whatever. And I can just tell you my own personal. I think the reason the Urantia book warns us against that kind of stuff is not so much because it's evil or demonic as much as it is. The problem is I think it can be a distraction. It can be a distraction from our relationship with God. Like going to psychics is a good example. You know, and I'm not trying to condemn anybody out there who's been to a psychic. I've been to psychics myself. Okay. The problem I think the problem comes when, for me, is I think that when we become too distracted or too focused on, you know, well, what's the future going to bring with it? You know, I believe it keeps us from living one day at a time, you know, in the present, and just focusing on our relationship with God and looking to God to solve our problems rather than, you know, looking to a psychic to, you know, it's like I was talking to a girl who was really into tarot cards and she's trying to predict the future, and she's like, I want to know about this shit before it happens. That's what she said. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that kind of, fixation on the future, you know, because Jesus tells us not to worry. He says, you know, to let each day, take each day as it comes. You know, he tells the apostles, consider the lilies of the field, you know, Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these, you know. So, you know, I believe we are to rest in the presence of God and to rest in his arms and not to be too concerned about the future.
I mean, in a way, going to a psychic, I think, is, you know, it's like going to a priest. It's not that much different. They're in the same kind of position. You're giving them a certain amount of power over you and your thoughts and I do think that's very wrong because it does take away from the fact that you should be resting with God and you're not. And you're allowing someone to change your view of the world where God is the perfect path and you're allowing someone else who's another fallible human being, maybe even worse than you, to do that for you. I think a lot of the stuff in the occult is about avoidance of change. Because I think we all know that the center of the gospel is about change. It's about inner change. It's about consistently changing when you have to. You know, there are times when you have to stand strong, but there are times when you have to change. And I think there's a lot of things people will go out of their way to avoid changing. They'll look for a reason not to when they know they have to. And they still have to change somewhere down the line, but it comes just before their own destruction most of the time because they look for any excuse, you know, not to do it. And a lot of occult practices will allow you, you know, to not change, basically, for a time.
And again, you know, they tell us, or Jesus, in that same discourse, the second discourse on religion, he really describes that as how we can flee to the shelter of that is known or that is told to us by someone in authority, whether it be a religion of authority or a psychic or a guru or, you know, the priest or whomever. You've given over your right to find God in yourself, of yourself, and for yourself. And you've given it over to this other person to tell you what to think about God.
And
how to approach God, and in every way, you've put a middleman into the greatest adventure there is in all of creation, and that is to find God. And each human being, you know, it's like it says, when man seeks for God, he seeks for everything. When he finds, he's found everything. And so, you know, that's your search, that's your adventure, and who am I to supplant myself in that adventure? And how do I know where God might take you or what lessons God has for you or for another person? And I think that's what you're, in a way, you're saying, you know, it's easier to just let someone else make those huge and important decisions for us and just give over our power to someone else who seems to be able to, you know, manage it better or whatever. You know, he seems to know what he's talking about, so I'm just going to let him decide for me who God is and how I should find God. But that's really not, according to the Urantia book, at least as I understand it, that's not what God would have us do. He would have us set out on the sea of high adventure to find him and to build up, you know, a religion of the spirit within our own hearts and souls.
a religion based on personal experience. And I think Andre, you've pointed out to me that, you know, sometimes it's easier to flee to that religion of authority because it's all laid out for you.
Right.
Cut and draw. And I think the psychic guru, channeler, whatever you want, you know, is another way of, again, avoiding that rigorous effort it takes on your own part to find the truth and live by it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there is also a difference between support and being led. You know, everyone needs support. I mean, the good side of organized religion is you do find support. There are people who will help you through bad times, you know, people you don't necessarily know because of their belief structure. And that's the good thing.
Well, and I think you know, going back to what we said before about the balance between individual personal religion and socialized religion, because I think the Your Answer Book tells us that they're both important. Now, Jesus didn't come here to create a socialized religion, but he did not oppose its creation, but he came here just for the individual. But the thing that a good example to me of a balance, and you mentioned this in your book, you refer a couple times to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think the 12-step groups. I'm in one. It's not for addiction, but I'm in one for adult children of dysfunctional families. And to me, that's a really great example because you get the support system, because you're also allowed to have your own personal spiritual experience.
Yeah, it is.
And
yeah.
I think that to me is a really good model.
I think
well,
so.
And you know,
I think so.
That some folks on the board are agreeing with you, Charlie. The good side of organized religion is the support, and I think that's absolutely right. I think that's why people get involved with churches. I know that for a fact with the Mormon Church. They provide a beautiful support system to anybody who gets involved with them, especially families. And you know, if you fall on hard times and you lose your job and your family is destitute, that church will rally around you and they'll get you through.
Exactly.
And that really is the best of any community, really. You can't fault a community for achieving that. That's
no, you can. No, you can't. I mean, it saves so many people. It saves so many people. I mean, in civilized society, in third world countries, you know, they all need that support. Without the church, a lot of countries will be in a lot better, worse state. You know, there's lots of people who are on social welfare who lose welfare and they don't have nowhere else to go. You know, and if the church wasn't there, that would be it, because a lot of people don't have any family either. You know, it provides that. You know, if you look at the Salvation Army, grassroots level.
It's like when we were in South Africa at the Parliament of the World's Religions in 1999, Nelson Mandela got up to address the Parliament, and it was the opening plenary, and he said something I'll never forget. He said, "I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for all of you." And that very statement kind of stunned everybody in the audience. You could just tell it took them back. And then he said, "Let me elaborate." He said, when I was wasting away in that prison on that island, he said, "It was you. It was religionists. It was the Christians. It was the Muslims. It was the Hindus and the Buddhists who came out on missions of mercy to minister to me. You all cared for me, and that's why I'm here. You came out to minister to me.
Yeah,
you all."
Yeah.
And so, you know, that to me is like the highest. The highest mission, the greatest beauty of socialized religion is that, you know, it does unite to serve and inspires members of its community to serve each other.
It is very important he said that, because otherwise people generally don't see the end result of the help that they give people. And for him to, you know, be elevated to that position by all those people along the way, he gave credence to the whole thing, you know. And explains how important it is.
It does, you know, and again, you know, for us humans, it's about balance. How do we achieve the best without falling into the pitfalls of the worst? And I think that's why, you know, the Urantia book, why Revelation is so important, because it illuminates both for us, and it allows us to see them and say, oh, yeah, I see that pitfall.
Yeah.
And we don't want to go there.
Sure.
Sometimes, you know, we overcorrect, you know, we overreact. In an effort to not go there, we do nothing. And that's just as bad, really.
Exactly. Yeah. the other chapter in my book, which I'd like to talk about, if I can lead the discussion a little bit along, if no one minds.
Before you go there, do you want to take a call or two?
If there's anyone waiting.
Yes. Hold on.
No, that hurt. No, that hurt.
281. You're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic.
Oh, you know what? Wait, no. She was just calling to listen.
Okay.
Just let her listen.
We have another one. Hold on, and we'll see. Maybe this is Ann, too. She may just want to listen. 817, is this Ann?
Yes. Hi, Paula. I'm actually listening. I had to go off of the I was getting too many verbal commercials, but that's okay. Good morning. enjoying your Brit accents here.
Oh, hi. How are you? Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Tremendous insights. Good morning, Andre.
Good morning, Ann.
What time is it there, Charlie? What time?
In England it's quarter to six at night.
Evening.
That's
nice. We don't have Kevin with us today for some reason from Tokyo. I'm not sure what's going on there. But don't you love live broadcasting? You get all kinds of sound effects. A couple of weeks ago we had someone calling and ordering pizza.
That's great.
I think pizza.
That's pretty funny.
So I'll just keep listening and interject if there's something. Enjoying it tremendously.
Yeah, we actually had a toilet flushing in the background one day. Some people get upset about that. They think it makes the show sound unprofessional. that's part of what I like about talk radio is how unscripted it is, how spontaneous it is. So
I enjoy the live aspect. Sure do.
It's life.
And well,
so,
I was trying to type,
Charlie, and
quickly
you were about to share another section of your book.
Yes,
with.
And I was trying to type when you were doing that, and it got pretty tricky. It was marvelous.
What, while you were flushing the toilet? Sorry, I lost the discussion there. Two people were talking at once.
And we lose our train of thought also, Charlie, because we do a Wednesday live broadcast.
Okay.
You're going to read from your book.
So, yeah. I was going to read a bit about atheism. Let me just... Yeah. Between where science ends and atheism begins is opinion. Science is a technique that can be used by anybody. Atheism does not own science. It does not belong to them. I think that's quite an important subject right now. We have a lot of new atheism going on in the world, and I think they've kind of captured science, and they're using that as some kind of sacred scripture, which they really have no right to do, because science is just a technique of measurement, really. It's about measuring the world. But I think atheism, seeing as it was born out of kind of the negativity of monotheistic religions, it was born out of not believing in God. They haven't had anything to hang on to until someone said, oh, let's use Darwinian science and evolution, and let's disprove everything in the biblical story of creation. And now everyone's saying, oh, but science says this, and science says that, and science says the other. And, it's there, and no one else can use science. And obviously, what it says in the Urantia book, science is... It's not that. It's not a sacred scripture, Does that make sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense. And I think that's why they often talk about secular science. And I guess the scientist is looking for proof for God, and if he can't find proof of God, some material proof that God exists, then he must let God go. And maybe that's why atheism thinks that they own science. What do you think about that, Charlie? Do you think, why is atheism and science so closely linked right now?
Again, I think they have no other than denying everything, and basing everything on what they think and what their limits of their own egos. I mean, it's essentially, I term atheism as the religion of the ego, because they can't really think beyond themselves. It's all about what's tangible and what they can touch, and obviously science is about what's tangible and what's provable. So some people, although they have the ability, they seem to refuse to want to use the ability to place any kind of understanding of things outside that. So they've have to have a structure. They have to have something that tells them that what they believe is valid. So they use science as that. That's my opinion. Mm. Or that's my suggestion or my discussion point, I guess.
Well, and I think that part of the problem is that, and this is one of the distinctions that the Urantia book makes for us, is the distinction between fact and truth. And I think that, you know, that science can science can give you facts, but it can't give you truth. And I think that, you know, I it's funny because there's a local atheist here in town. His name is Rob Sherman, and he's always trying to...
Local atheist.
he is like the village atheist. I mean, he is in the Chicago area. I mean, he's constantly suing people because he doesn't like religious public displays of religious symbols and things like that. But anyway, one of the things that he likes to say, God is make-believe. And I may have an opportunity to meet him shortly, soon. Actually, I actually interviewed him on the radio back in 1993. Well, it wasn't actually on the radio. It was actually part of a tape that I was sending out. It was a hypothetical sort of project radio show. But anyway, he is a, what was I going to say about him? I'm trying to remember now. Oh, I may have an opportunity to meet him again, and I may ask him some questions, like, you know, just because something isn't measurable, that doesn't mean it's not true. I mean, you know, he's married, so I may ask him, you know, do you love your wife? Well, can you measure love? Can you put love in a box?
Sure,
You know, I'd like to see what he says about that, you know, just because, you know, that comes from, and, you know, to get all philosophical, that point of view that something is only true if it's measurable or verifiable, that's philosophically, that's called logical positivism. And logical positivists believe that. They believe that the only kind of truth was that which could be verified empirically. Well, then you'd have to completely get rid of all poetry and all good literature and Shakespeare, and you'd have to get rid of, you know, anything that's not tangible, you know. And again, but I think that the fact is that, or the truth is, that we all, if we really are honest with ourselves, we all experience things that are not tangible to the human senses, that there's a part of us that's, you know, that goes beyond that, that we're not just, you know, we're not just animals. You know, we have the ability to sense things that are beyond just the physical.
Exactly. I mean, there's the old issue of where is the seat of consciousness, you know? Where does the spirit lie? Well, why? I mean, as far as I know, no one has verified where the seat of the human consciousness is, and the link between the mind and the body and the spirit. I mean, what is that? And it's avoided by, you know, atheism, because science has not approached it. It seems to be a bit of a blank area for them.
You know, the Urantia book really tells us that we can't convince an unbeliever of the existence of God. Essentially, there's really no such proof that they might require. And it almost hints at the futility of, you know, and it comes up in several places. I'm thinking of Jesus and the thoughtless pagan. He and Gannett are walking along, and they meet this thoughtless pagan, and Gannett is really intrigued by the fact that Jesus doesn't try to engage him in a spiritual conversation. And Jesus tells him, you know, Gannett, the man was not ready. And the fruit must be allowed more time to ripen upon the tree. And I think, wow, you know, I love that metaphor, because who among us would ever go even think of picking a piece of unripe fruit? I mean, it's so obvious. It's not ready.
Well, you know, another thing I like about that, Paula, is, you know, that's such a contrast to some fundamentalist Christians I know who will just want to evangelize everybody. And Jesus is saying,
absolutely.
Just leave the guy alone. You know, notice he doesn't condemn a man. He doesn't condemn him. He doesn't say, oh, he's headed for hell. He doesn't say that. He just says, you need to wait for the fruit to ripen on the tree. It's not the right time. And timing is so important because I believe that I'm absolutely convinced that we shouldn't do things before we're ready to do them. And you know, God is a gentleman. God knocks on the door. He doesn't bounce. He doesn't try to break the door down, you know. And so I'm so convinced that you know, we can't do things until we're ready, and we can't receive certain truths until we're ready.
And you know, obviously, I mean, I've met atheists who were just as angry and impenetrable as the most staunch fundamental religionist in their beliefs. I've had them yell in my face, "Your God lets people suffer," you know. And you can try to reason with that, but it's not an easy thing to do. And it just reminds me of the Urantia book telling us, you know, the true believer speaks of his faith for the mutual edification of believers, not to convince unbelievers.
Yeah, okay. I think readiness is the moot point. Although I do know for a fact that the most rabid atheists are very often really earnestly seeking for the truth.
Absolutely. Yes, I agree with you because you can just get to their defenses, and you know, a lot of times sometimes it has nothing to do with intellectual stuff. It's that they're angry about something else. You know, it's really not. You know, maybe they've been hurt by some religious person or something. You know, or maybe they just had some terrible trauma in their life, and they just, you know, what I think is really interesting though is I think we talked about this on the show before, how I don't think there's anything wrong with being angry with God. I think being angry with God is okay. Because at least people who are angry with God, at least they're thinking about God, you know.
Yeah.
And at least that, to me, that means that they have a relationship with God. I think anger with God and frustration with God can actually be a form of prayer. There's a great song by a band you may know, Charlie, actually a British band called XTC. There's a song called Dear God, and they say in that song, you know, "Dear God, I can't believe in you." But obviously he's talking to God, so he's, you know, I think what he's saying is, "I can't trust you." Not that I can't believe in you, you know, I can't believe in you in the same, you know, I can't have faith in you, I can't trust you. But he's not saying there's no God, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of people who say there is no God, they'll blame him next time something goes wrong. You know, that's something other people do otherwise, you know. They say, "Oh, I don't believe in God," and they're like, this happened, it's God's fault. I never believe in God because of this. It's like, why do you blame him in the first place? You know, you don't believe in God anyway, so what's the people?
I had a guy tell me once years ago, when I was a teenager, this is before I found the Urantia book, we were talking about God, and his comment to us was, "Well, I'm an atheist, thank God."
That's great. That's great.
And we both started laughing. We just laughed out loud, and he said, "What?" And we said, do you know what you just said? He goes, "What?" We said, "You said you're an atheist. Thank God." And he had to chuckle too, you know.
Well, at least he's got a sense of humor, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I have to agree. I don't want to be hard on atheists. In fact, in a way, I honor them because at least they're thinking. But what you know, and they're rejecting nonsense. And who could blame them for rejecting things that are nonsensical? I mean, God ought to make sense, you know. Religion ought to make sense.
Yeah, that's true.
By the same token, it just seems like everybody in the world almost has a problem separating God from religions.
Yeah, and I agree with what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying, Paul. That a lot of atheists are rejecting nonsense. I do think, however, though, that the agnostic position is at least more honest than the atheist position, because a true atheist, you know, you can't. It's actually kind of an arrogant position to take, because, I mean, how can you know for sure that there's no God? At least an agnostic is going to admit that they don't know. I think it's a little more of a humble position to take.
Well, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, sorry.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, I was I was just going to pick up the point that Andre was making earlier about measuring, you know, measuring emotions and measuring the human spirit and measuring things you can't touch, measuring love, and you can't do it. Yet everyone experiences it. You can't measure truth. You know, everyone experiences it, but you can't put it there and say that's this and that's that. And it's impossible, you know. You can only do it by your own experience and you know, explain that to an atheist or tell that to an atheist and watch himself time himself in knots. I don't know, you know. It's, as far as I know, you know, it's about spirit, and it's about learning. I mean, why do we learn? You know, why do our bodies decay, and why do our minds and our spirit, why do they develop? Why do they, you know, carry on going? Why do we become more patient? Why do we learn more love? Why do we accrue these spiritual values as our bodies decay? Why? What's the purpose? If we're just going to die, if we have no soul, if we're not going to go anywhere else, you know.
That is such a beautiful fundamental question. Why indeed? I mean, if a person can answer that question honestly, and I often pose it to people, you know, in order to say, this is why I believe in God. Essentially, because I refuse to believe that we live this life and gain this knowledge, and it's all for naught.
Yeah. I mean, a true atheist, in a way, a true atheist should have no love anyway. A true atheist should not, you know, if they believe that we're just sets of chemicals, you know, or a biological accident, why do we care when other people die? I mean, why? We should just be pleased that we have this population advantage now, that there's less ones to, you know, get our food or get our shelter or whatever, you know. Why are we concerned with other people? You know, if we're not spiritual, if we have no spirit, if there is no God.
You know, I often tell people, some people think that God is a word without a meaning. But for me, God is a meaning without a word.
Indeed.
We have to put a word on it because we want to describe it, but really, it's a meaning. You know, the Universal Father is a meaning that's transcendental of all meanings and a value that's so sublime that it really doesn't, language just doesn't do it justice. We want to describe it because we experience it, but it's transcendental. It's hard to describe. And that's, you know, that's where we get stuck.
Yeah, you know, we have to have a reference point, you know. Language is our reference point. It's our common reference point. So, yeah, that's why we use language, I guess.
Right. Well, share something else with us from your book.
Okay. I'll just have a quick look. Unless Andre has something he would like to discuss.
Oh, no, it's okay. I'm waiting for you to find another passage to read.
Okay. Do you want to sing a little song while you're waiting for me to look?
Paula, you can sing.
Yeah, but I have a frog in my throat today for some reason. I don't know.
Actually, Bob Lawson's been calling in and singing with us on Wednesday. I'm doing these little promos for our Wednesday broadcast. Did you notice that, Andre and Paula?
That you're doing what?
Promos for our Wednesday broadcast. Your sister broadcast on Wednesdays that got ignited out of this.
Oh.
You need to remember to promote us.
Oh, yeah, you know, that's a good point. That's a very good point. We do have a show that is an offshoot of The Cosmic Citizen on Wednesday mornings. What time does that go on? At 7? Is it 7 a.m. Central?
No, we start later than that. We start at 11 o'clock Eastern time.
Oh, you do?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
11. We go audio from 11 to noon Eastern time.
Okay. But before that, you have a chat session, right?
Right. For 1 hour, we do a chat. Just as it's almost like going to a study group, and we came to terms with that, where you just kind of step in and what is the word, Paul? Just chatting. Because we've tried to get into discussions and we said, wait a minute, we're just chatting here. Because a lot of times our guests step into the chat room and we prepare. So it's a different mode. And this Wednesday, I'll go ahead while Charlie's finding that book, we're having a retired Methodist minister. And he is a Urench book reader. And Reverend Thomas, and he's going to step in with us live. We were going to record it, but he agreed to come in live. Last Wednesday, Paula, can you say that gentleman's name? I have the hardest time of saying the great Japanese Zen Buddhist monk and scholar and visionary. So everybody can go to the website and see.
It's Yoshiko, I think.
Yoshiko. Yeah, now that you said, I can say marvelous insights, visionary, aware of the Urantia book, but doesn't read it, Andre, as you called that, out of the box, right?
Yes.
And we enjoyed it tremendously. Okay, Charlie, I've finished with my advertisement.
You didn't have a jingle.
Okay. Jingle.
I think morality is a good one to talk about.
Hmm.
I'm going to read part of my book, fragments of my book on morality. It goes, true, consistently accurate morality lies only in the Father's will. Conscious consideration of the human relative concepts of good and evil requires much effort and results in a kind of double-mindedness. Instead, seek the Father's will, the voice of God lying with your spirit, which carries with it the perfect plan for your life as well as a perfect moral decision for each situation. The spiritual mind must not then be torn in discerning good and evil, which is a distraction in relativity. It must, the mind, battle only with the stimulations of the world and the electrochemical urges of the body to attain discernment of the small, still voice of the eternal spirit within.
Mm.
So basically I'm saying that human morality can be, you know, not... it can be too rigid, basically. I mean, it's an important area when we're talking about religion, organized religion, the church, and personal spirituality, because I think morality lies only with God, really, and in his path for your life. Who's to tell you, really, what is morally right for you other than God, you know? I mean,
well, yes, except that the interesting thing about that is that you can be moral without being spiritual. In fact, the Urantia book tells us that you have to be moral before you can be spiritual. You don't get a thought adjuster until you make your first moral decision. So so atheists actually can be moral and people. But as far as, you know, it's interesting. I think the Urantia book doesn't give us a moral code. You know, it doesn't tell us this is right, this is wrong, this is what you should do. On the other hand, and I think, you know, boy, that's really interesting. I certainly agree that morality can be too rigid. It can be like a straitjacket. If you have, in fact, that's known in Christian circles as legalism. A lot of churches have these man-made rules. You know, you can't wear your hair a certain length. You know, got to do this, you got to do that. You know, and that kind of stuff, I agree with you. On the other hand, I don't think morality can be completely individual because it involves relationships with other people. So if you, anything that involves someone other than yourself is
sure
going to involve a certain degree of, you know, I think there's a role for a shared morality, but I think it's got to be flexible. You know, it can't be one that is, you know, we're going to have to keep everything the same for thousands and thousands of years. It has to adapt to changing situations and changing circumstances. And I think that, you know, that's kind of where that, you know, goes. So,
you know, it's really interesting that you should bring this up because, Tuesday night is my study group night.
Okay.
And we were reading in the Jesus Papers, the sojourn at Tyre and Sidon. And Jesus does those wonderful teachings at Tyre. section 5, Jesus' teachings at Tyre, which that whole section is just like boom, 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 one after another, just food for thought. It sounds a lot like your book, Charlie. just, you know, you could chew on that section forever probably, but he gives that parable of the of carpentry, and it says it's one of the only times he ever does this. And he says, build well the foundations for the growth of a noble character of spiritual endowments. In order to yield the fruits of the Spirit, you must be born of the Spirit. You must be taught by the Spirit and be led by the Spirit if you would live the Spirit-filled life among your fellows. But do not make the mistake of the foolish carpenter who wastes valuable time squaring, measuring, and smoothing his worm-eaten and inwardly rotten timber, and then, when he has thus bestowed all of his labor upon the unsound beam, thus rejected as unfit to enter into the foundations of the building which he would construct to withstand the assaults of time and storm. Let every man make sure that the intellectual and moral foundations of character are such as will adequately support the superstructure of the enlarging and ennobling spirit nature, which is thus to transform the mortal mind, and then, in association with that recreated mind, is to achieve the evolvement of the soul of immortal destiny. And I think in some ways it's what you're talking about, you know, as somebody brought up the point, you know, everything that was considered immoral at one time is now moral, and everything that is considered immoral now was moral at another time.
Sure, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say everything, but a lot of things, yes, I would agree.
Wow. I mean, you know, I mean, you can see, and the Urantia book deals with this directly. It talks about the changing mores, and I think that's what he's talking about. As we change and grow, we must reevaluate our moral character and our mores and elevate them to the new standard of our own spiritual growth. And I think each one of us have probably experienced this in our own lives, too, in our own growth, where what we thought was perfectly okay 20 years ago,
right,
we wouldn't dream of doing now.
Or there are things that we have the strength to do now that we didn't have the strength to do then. I mean, I've been thinking about some things. I've been recently changing the way that I relate to women. And not that I was terrible the way I related to women in the past, but there's certain things I used to do that I would justify that I no longer will do. And I think that I also have the strength to say no to those things now. And I didn't have the strength, I think, in the past. Or maybe I did, but I wasn't aware that I did. I don't know. Sometimes you have to learn things the hard way, unfortunately.
I wish we
didn't have to make our own mistakes. I wish we could learn from other people's mistakes. But you know what? If we didn't make our own mistakes, then other people couldn't learn from our mistakes either. So, But it's like there's that one song, that Billy Joel song, "You're Only Human." He says, "Mistakes are the only things you can truly call your own." I think that's a great
quote. Yeah, that's a great quote. Yeah. Yeah, it goes back to what Andre was saying about atheists. I mean, yeah, they can be moral. I mean, but it is based on learning again. It's based on, you know, common sense morality, really. It's based on cause and effect. And I think what Paula was saying from the quote from the Urantia book is that you need to have something which you can then build on. Can build the voice of God into your life, which gives you then accentuates that morality. I think you have to have a common sense structure before you can then be open to anything from above, from God, and to fine tune that and to go on with that and develop it.
Yes. Well, and you know, in Jesus, in the parable, he's talking about to shoring up your inwardly rotten timber. And what occurs to me is that, you know, oftentimes we spend an awful lot of time rationalizing and justifying something we're doing when we know in our hearts it's wrong.
We do.
And eventually we must reject it.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah. But those lessons come hard sometimes, you know. I mean, morality is a tough one. Our conference this summer, Charlie, the Fellowship Summer Seminar, is going to be at Techni University in July. It's a conference, a retreat center, Techni campus. And the topic is cosmic morality.
Oh, that'd be interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm really cogitating on that. I'm really, you know, the implications of cosmic morality. You have any thoughts on that?
Cosmic Morality. I'm just having a look in my book. I think there's a little quote which I quite like. I'm quite fond of this one, or proud of this one, which goes, "The only way to truly empower oneself is through proper use and development of your morals and virtues. That is the only way to be beautiful, not through some random genetic identity such as race or perceived social class." So I think I'm basically saying that, you know, again, to develop those morals, you know, we're not cosmic yet. We're not cosmic enough to have a big cosmic morality, because we don't see the big enough picture, but we're still in the material state, you know. I'd like to go to that conference. That'd be great, but no, I'm not going to make it, no. Where is it?
It's
in the Chicago area.
It's in Chicago. Okay.
Yeah. And it's really nice because, you know, a lot of the Chicago folks, like Andre, will be there, and, you know, the trustees often come, they're planning to come. And so it's always a great conference. It's much more of an intense study of a subject. So
it's also smaller. It's also a smaller group of people. Usually it's more intimate than some of the larger conferences.
Yeah. So cosmic morality is a big subject in the Urantia book, no doubt about it. And, you know, all of the, obviously, I commend you for touching on so many big subjects, Charlie, in your book.
Yeah, I mean, it leads me on to how I really wrote it, because I didn't really sit down and think I was going to write a book. The way I wrote it was essentially, I thought about every thought I had, which I thought was profound. You know, I thought, oh, that's a good idea. That's a good point. Wow, you know, I wrote it down instead of letting it pass by and thinking, oh, I wish I'd wrote that down. Everyone has these ideas about whatever it is, you know, creative ideas, philosophic ideas. I wrote them down. I did it over 6 years, and I eventually got to the point when I was praying about them, and I was listening to the show. I think it was Alison Zopel a few weeks ago. And there was a point where you mentioned that sometimes the best point of contact with your adjuster is just before you wake up or just after you wake up,
right,
where you're still in this kind of zone. And I used to get all these things which were in my book. They used to come through at that point, and there was this voice saying, "Get out of bed, get out of bed, get out of bed, get out of bed." I was going, "No, no, no, you know, let me pass on this one." And that's basically the way I wrote it. I wrote it in a very random way sometimes. And so I'd have something, you know, from one chapter, and then I'd write something completely different which didn't even relate to it. And over 6 years, it became this concept which eventually interrelated and became a kind of circle. It became a bit more complete, and then I could see themes, and I could see the way it all interrelated to each other and what it was talking about. And it's a very interesting way to write a book. So I didn't sit down and write it from beginning to end. I wrote it in little dots which eventually started joining up.
So as the spirit moved you, and in these zones these quiet zones when you were communing with God, you got up and wrote down these thoughts, and then later you started to see the patterns, and you organized them thematically.
I did, yeah. And it developed into this thing, and it seems, and then I thought I'd intend to do something with it, and I thought, well, you know, I've read the Urantia book, and I've absorbed a lot of the stuff from that, and I've read the Bible, and I've absorbed stuff from that, and from my own life, and from my own common sense experience, you know, and eventually it's developed into something which is somewhere in between the Urantia book and my experiences of the Christian church and outside the Christian church, and from my experience with martial arts and being involved in the occult and all those non-helpful spiritual truths, tendencies, and systems of power, and it's drawn from a very varied background. It's a very broad thing. It's a lot of truths. It's all my truths, basically. I've had a lot of negative experience in my life. You know, I mean, I've had a lot of family tragedy, and I've had a lot of without elaborating, but it's allowed me to see the fruits of these things, of these truths. I can see a lot of truth. A lot of people have that ability when they go through trauma. You become much more sensitive to it. Listening to Alison on her show when she was saying, you know, I can hear my adjuster, I know the difference. That's very fortunate for her. That's the real benefit of her experience, which was a harsh experience. It's not an easy experience whatsoever, but she's been left with this incredible blessing. And I think when you go through a lot of traumas, you know, adversity, the Arantia book calls it, you know, do we like adversity? I can't remember what's the quote. Is adversity desirable? You know, yes, it is, because it has these spiritual fruits. You know, it's all about seeing more truth, and truth, I think, essentially is God, you know, because he's a source of truth.
Right, you know, certainly, I mean, the book, that's another theme that the book carries throughout, and the value of a sorrowful experience, the value of the things that challenge us the most, adversity, that we are challenged in adversity, and we grow through that adversity, and we become better people. And it comes right out and says, the greatest affliction in the universe is never to have been afflicted.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, yes, yes. So I think looking at the Arantia book, it's an amazing, amazing source of information. It's incredible. I think for a lot of people, though, it was for me, and I think for a lot of people who pick it up, you have to have spiritual tendencies anyway to look at it in the first place. But it's very complicated. It's very complex. It's not easy to read. And at times your brain is being baked.
Charlie, because, you know, you're saying that, like, you talk about how a lot of spiritual books go on and on and on, and they're not very succinct.
Mm.
Your book is very succinct, but the Arantia book is very complex. It's kind of the opposite of your book in a lot of ways. Your book is you write in very short, sort of terse sentences, where the Arantia book is these really long-winded passages. And I guess one thing I was curious, just out of curiosity, what kept you reading the Arantia book when you first found it?
The truth.
Mm.
Just the truth in it. Being drawn to the truth. And the fantastical quality of it. I mean, there's a real otherworldly quality of it, and more of understanding more of Jesus beyond what you can get from people in the church. I think if you spend a lot of time with really knowledgeable Christians who've lived a lot of stuff, you can gain something similar, but it's set out a lot in the text in the Arantia book already. You know, so you can find a lot of really good stuff there, you know, and a lot of the motor in there is incredible, and just the mind expanding that you get from reading the Arantia book, it's beyond anything else I've read, really. But it is an effort, and I thought if I can produce something which leads people towards this and gives them some buildings and tools to be able to spiritualize them, or give them a bit of a spiritual leaning to be brought into this, you know, instead of going there from a state of not knowing anything, or, you know, looking at the Bible, it's a very symbolic document. It's people learn about it through symbology, and again, it takes time. I thought, well, what I've written is because it's been written through me as a person, without going into the whole channeling argument, because I think that's, well, you know, without using swear words, I'm not really into that kind of thing. I think that using the voice of your adjuster is basically what is given to you. I don't think you have to channel other beings, you know, regardless of going into the origins of the Arantia book. I don't really want to go there. I don't know quite what to think about that. There's so many theories and everything, but
well,
I'd like to think of my...
It's interesting to mention the channeling thing, Charlie, because, you know, somebody... It's funny because... you know, the ironic thing about the Arantia book is, even though the Arantia book claims to be revelation from other beings, it discourages people from getting involved in what they call mediumship, you know, or which is sort of a 1930s way of talking about channeling. It's just kind of funny that they, even though the book claims your revelation from beings, from other beings, it discourages us from trying to contact the spirit world. You know, again, I think it's because, again, it's a distraction. It's a distraction from a daily, you know, the daily, just a daily, steady, consistent relationship with God that we would have.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and look at Jesus. I mean, nobody on earth that has ever lived could have said more accurately, hey, I've got a word for you from Melchizedek. You know, or here's some advice from the source. He was literally in communion with a self-acting thought adjuster. He communed with Gabriel and with Father Melchizedek. He, you know, he conversed with angels. We know that he did, but he never said to anybody, "An angel just told me to tell you this."
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think there's a reason why, because when you say that, you take the person's choice away to believe it or not. You're adding what I call the weight of celestial authority onto the words, so that the person now can't say, well, yeah, that sounds true. You know, they have to think that if they don't believe it now, they're disobeying the spirit world, you know.
Again, it's creating a middleman, isn't it? It's saying,
right.
I have this power, yeah.
Yeah, it's taking the power away from the person to hear the truth. And believe it if they hear the truth in it, and decide for themselves if that's true or not for them.
Yeah.
And it's taking that power away from them and forcing them to hear something that may or may not be true for them.
Okay, I must interrupt, Paula, because my phone has just told me I've got about 30 seconds before I get cut off. I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to say goodbye.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yeah. I know it's racist, doesn't it? I didn't get any warning.
Tell people how they can get your book again.
Tell me how.
Yeah.
You can go to my site, charliefox.biz, which is the easiest way, or lulu.com or amazon.com.
Okay, the book is called Being Like Water.
Yeah.
By Charlie Fox. Thank you, Mr. Fox, for being on our show. And we really appreciate it. It was good to have a global perspective. No good to have the international thing going.
No, it's brilliant. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Love you. Love you both. All right.
Thank you. We love you too.
Thanks, Charlie.
Well, Paula, that's an example, I guess, of a person who is kind of bootlegging the Urantia teachings, you know, taking the teachings of the Urantia book and kind of, you know, putting them into bite-sized chunks for people without actually mentioning the Urantia book, and I think that that's great. I think that that's one of the many ways. That, you know, there's no one way to share the truth. That's one of the many ways we can share the truth. You know, there are other people who are much more upfront about sharing the Urantia book with people, and, you know, while we're on the show, that's what we do. But if I'm going to a Bible study with my Christian friends, I don't mention the Urantia book at all. I just plant little seeds. And I think that, you know, that there are all kinds of approaches to get the truth out to people. And I think, you know, and if we can get, it's like Jesus said, you know, he only gave his apostles what they could assimilate. And sometimes people can't assimilate the whole Urantia book. They just need little pieces, or they might just need part four, which is why I have no problem with the separate book, you know, with the part four publication. Or they might just, you know, need little pieces like what Charlie is doing. So I just think it's great that there are all these different ways to get the truth out.
Well, you know, Andre, we know for a fact that a lot of mainstream writers have read the Urantia book, and you can hear it in what they're saying. People like Deepak Chopra, Wayne Dyer, Stephen Covey. You know, there's just a lot of them who have been especially big. Timothy Wiley, Ask Your Angels, he read the Urantia book and uses it, incorporates it. And I think, maybe the best example is J.J. Benitez. In the Spanish-speaking world, J.J. Benitez wrote a whole series of books, I think 7 books, and several of them are just direct excerpts almost from the Urantia book. One is called The Trojan Horse. It's about a time traveler who goes back in time and hangs out with Jesus and the apostles. Another one is called The Lucifer Rebellion. These have been bestsellers in Spanish-speaking countries. And what they've done is they have paved the way. They've tilled the soil for the Urantia book. And J.J., you know, he didn't, J.J. Benitez did mention the Urantia book and give credit to it, so... You know, it really has paved the way because now, you know, the Urantia book is taking off in Spanish-speaking countries.
Yeah, I've heard that. I'd love to go to some of those Spanish study groups. I've always been attracted to Latin culture anyway, and I think I've heard that when they do the Jesus birthday celebration in Mexico, they make a cake and it's a big deal, and it's like, you know, I'd love to go to some of those Spanish speaking countries and see what that's like. One of my absolute favorite writers, he died a few years ago, is M. Scott Peck, and I was told he was a iambic reader. I always suspected that, but I don't have solid, you know, rock solid proof that he was. But it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, most of these great writers, too, the ones that I mentioned, they read a lot of stuff. I mean, they read everything, and it only stands to reason that the Urantia book would come into their sphere because it is so intellectually high. That of course they will have been offered that book at some point because they are, you know, they're thinking at a high level themselves anyway, and you know, they incorporate that, but they also incorporate the thinking of many great people, and I love that about people like them. Michael Beckwith comes to mind. He is an amazing teacher of truth. He does the Agape Church in L.A., in the L.A. area, and that's an offshoot of Science of Mind. And he can quote different religious authors and different great religious thinkers just at the drop of a hat. And I admire that so much because when he gets up to speak in front of an audience, he is so inspiring. And he'll say, you know, we've asked him, have you read the Urantia book, Michael? And he'll say, oh, yes, more universal truth, you know. So that's really incredible when you meet someone like that who just digests so much beautiful spiritual philosophy and they can just call it up at will. I really admire that.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Well, we probably have about, 25 minutes left?
Yeah. Crystalline is asking me to mention M. Scott Peck's community building workshop. And Crystalline, why don't you give us a call here and you can talk to us about it for a minute, whatever you like. Call us up. There's a workshop by M. Scott Peck that Crystalline has set up. It's in Buffalo, New York, this spring, and she's done some great work on that and got them to agree to do this workshop for us, and it's really affordable. And I'm sorry, darling, I don't know all of the details on that, but she's saying she has no voice. I'm reading her on the board right now, Andre, and
okay,
listener.
Okay. Well, I know that there's a great book by Scott Peck called The Different Drum, which is a book about community. And as I said, Scott Peck unfortunately passed away, but I guess that he had a foundation called the Foundation for Community Encouragement. And I guess that they're the ones that do these workshops around the country now, community building workshops.
Yeah, they do. And she has called them about doing a workshop for us, and they've agreed to do it. And I think it's like $100 tuition, and that's it. And it's over a weekend in May. Oh, well, here she is. Let's see if we can get her to talk about it.
Yeah, they do. And
Crystalline, is that you?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Oh, you have no voice.
Well, I just had a scope stuck down my throat yesterday.
Oh.
So you'll have to bear with me.
Okay. Well, tell us about the M. Scott Peck community building seminar that you have graciously set up for all of us.
Well, thank you. I'm really excited about it. We have people coming from all the different Urantia organizations, from Urantia University, from the UAI, from the Fellowship, from Inner Life International, from the United Urantia Family Group, and the seminar is a weekend. It's a two-day weekend workshop from the 16th to the 18th of April. And it's designed to encourage authentic community development. And
you said April 15th through the 16th?
16th through the 18th.
Oh, 16th through the 18th. Okay, I'm writing it down. So.
And it's really terrific because it's only $100 for the whole workshop. And we have about 10 people so far that are signed up, and we're hoping to have 20 to 25 people from all the different Urantia organizations. Oh, yeah, we've also got some UB youth representatives there as well. But it's instead of just talking about building community or just talking about having community in our movement, it's really helping us to actually gain the tools that we need to really make that happen and to help us overcome conflicts that have been ongoing for decades and to learn to work together amicably. And for those people who have read M. Scott Peck's work, it's right in line with the kind of world community that the Urantia book talks about.
Beautiful. And what does the $100 cover? Is that just tuition?
That's the actual cost of the workshop.
Okay, so anybody coming would have to be responsible to get there, and then for their own accommodations and food.
We do have some discounts set up with one of the hotels that's just right around the corner from where the event will be held. So it's going to be pretty affordable. And there are a few people who have offered to help subsidize the expense for people who want to come who may not be able to afford, you know, their housing, et cetera. Because we feel like this is a really important program, and we'd like to get as many people there as possible. Go ahead.
Well, where should they, who should they contact? Shall I put down your email, or what would you like?
Yeah, they should contact me at beekch@comcast.net. That's B as in boy, IEKCH@comcast.net.
Okay, got it. I sent it out to you on this.
And if people are interested in finding out more about the organization that's facilitating this event for us, if they look at the Foundation for Community Encouragement, if they Google Foundation for Community Encouragement, they will get their website and be able to look up more information.
Cool.
But it's been really exciting because for years I've been a fan of Scott Peck's work. And years ago when we first started running into the kinds of political problems that we've had in our movement, I remember thinking, oh, we have to get M. Scott Peck to come do a resolution workshop for us. And because it's really about how we can work together amicably and harmoniously without seeing things the same way, without having to let go of our intrinsic belief structure or, our political point of view, that really isn't necessary for us to all think alike in order to love each other and to be able to work together amicably. And then I was so disappointed because when he passed away, the time wasn't right, or the community wasn't ready, to really embrace this concept. And just last year, the foundation reorganized itself and came back together to keep going with Scott Peck's work. And it really is a mission for them to support and encourage community in all different arenas around the world. And so the people who are facilitating this workshop really are mission-minded and very committed to this. And I've had spectacular exchanges with them. And not only are they going to do the workshop in April, but they've also agreed to come to the United Urantia Family Festival.
Wow.
And do a program ongoing throughout that whole weekend.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thanks for making
that. That's really impressive, Chris. I'm really impressed by that. I've always been I've always been a Scott Peck fan, and I always liked the, I read The Different Drum, his book on community. I read it as a freshman in college, actually.
Right.
And actually, before what struck me about it was the way he described the weekends and the workshops. It reminded me of something I was involved in. My first experience of community, actually, real community, was when I was in high school. I was involved in a group called Operation Snowball, and it was a drug and alcohol prevention program for teenagers. And you'd go on these retreats called Snowballs, and you by the end of the retreat you'd be all high. I mean, it was just an opportunity for teenagers to experience real community and real friendship. And the whole point of the experience was to let kids know that they don't have to drink or do drugs to have a natural high. But it was we would do these. It was the first time I really experienced. It was just the first time that I really experienced community, and a lot of the stages that he describes in the book, I thought I could relate to a lot of the stages of community building that he described, and so to really be a part of that directly, I think to be working with his foundation, I think would just be a great privilege. I mean, I just think that's just fascinating. I mean, I think what he did was so great.
That's how I felt about it, too. It was one of those things that just really felt, I felt really driven, and I was so happy to not only to find out that they were back together again and that they were functioning as a foundation and as a teaching organization, but that they were willing not only to work with us in a short term, but that they were willing to stay involved with us in a long term.
Wow. By the way, I got to ask you out of curiosity, Crystal. Do you? I don't know if you've asked them or if they know, but I read something on the internet somewhere where someone supposedly quoted Scott Peck as saying that he had gotten a lot of inspiration from the Urantia book. But I don't know if that's true or if that's just like a hearsay thing. Have you heard anything about that?
I heard the same thing, but again, I don't know if it's true either. And since he's passed away, there's no way for me to verify.
Right. I wondered if anybody at the foundation would know, the foundation or community.
I don't know, but I can tell you that they were all sure very open to working with us. And I felt like we were really on the same page. There's also something else that I wanted to share with regards to this project. I had sent out an invitation to a group of people that I considered sort of leaders in our movement, people who were really interested in sort of facilitating peace or unity or the different groups working together. And one of the people I had sent the invitation to was Phil Taylor. And
who?
Phil Taylor.
Oh,
excuse me, my voice is a little rough today. And I got back this email from Phil saying, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're doing this. Like, we've been working on this youth leadership forum for almost the past year, and we're using a different drum, the book, a different drum, as one of our primary source materials for putting this summit together or this forum together." And he says, "So we've been basically working with these principles for the last year. And, how ironic that, we're all on the same page on this." It sort of felt like a very clear indication that there were blue skies ahead. So
I wonder why he calls his book A Different Drum. Because usually when I think of a different drum, I think of an individual beating to the drum, beating a different drum. And it's kind of funny that he would use that to describe community.
I don't know. I mean, it does seem like people who are really interested in having authentic community experience or maybe, you know, at least 20 years ago when he wrote that book, sort of stood out in the crowd. I think nowadays we find more and more people are talking about authentic community and are wanting to have that experience. But, you know, when he wrote the book, I think people were still really caught up in a very materialistic drive. Who knows?
Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
We have somebody asking on the board, what's his foundation again, Chrislyn and I?
It's called the Foundation.
Huh?
It's called the Foundation for Community Encouragement.
Okay.
And they've also just recently started a page on Facebook, and their website is FCE, as in Foundation for Community Encouragement, FCE-community.org.
Okay, that's the website. I'll grab this. I just found it. I'll grab it and put it on the board.
So I've gotten emails from people all over the country wanting to know what this workshop is about, and is this based on the Urantia book, or is this something for, you know, what's the political agenda for this event? And the political agenda for this event is for us to really learn how to love and work with each other. And I don't know if you can call that a political
I think it's way beyond politics.
So anyway, thanks for taking my call.
You know, Chris, I'll just go ahead and say, I was going to say this to you off the air, but I'll just go ahead and say this now. We'd love to get somebody on the air from that foundation. I would love to get to do a show on not only on the event, but on the foundation and what they're trying to do. We'd love to set something up like that for next month if you could help us out with that. That would be wonderful.
Sure, absolutely. They're wonderful people, and you know, they just reconnected their foundation just about a year or a year and a half ago.
Are they in Tennessee? For some reason, I thought they were in Tennessee.
They're in Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
But they have facilitators all over the country.
Wow.
And they're actively involved in trying to expand the number of facilitators that they have. So
wow.
That's something that I'm very
interested in. Do they have training weekends and things?
Yes, they do.
Wow. That would be a great thing to get involved in. I think they're just, wow.
I mean, they really want to change the world. And they're going about it, I think, in a way that's very practical and very palpable.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's never an easy job, but somebody's got to do it.
What happens if we don't try, you know? What happens if we give it up?
Exactly.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, the thing that people forget is we have the tools. I mean, I'm not saying we have all the tools, but we have some of the tools. We have a good start, and I think that we have an understanding. I think we have some unprecedented understandings that I think it's up to us to act on them, you know.
Well, and I think we have all experienced, you know, that we have high expectations of how our relationships with other Urantia book readers should go.
Yes.
And we are frequently disappointed when we find out that they're not perfect. And my sense about that is that we have too high of an expectation.
Yes, I would agree.
For people to instantly be transformed in every way once they've read the Urantia book. And we don't have a clear understanding that the Urantia book touches people where they are and wherever they've come from. And that's where they start to imbibe these principles. Or in some cases, they've sort of been on the path all their lives, and the Urantia book comes along and just, you know, fits right in with where they were already going. But, you know, most of us, I mean, we all come from a double default decimal planet.
Wow. Would that be a double default?
That's great alliteration, and it's a D cubed, I guess.
Right. And most of us have had, dysfunctional family issues. Even if we come from the very best of families, we've had, some kinds of experience in dealing with community where we have felt betrayed or we have felt injured or personally attacked at some point or another. It's challenging sometimes for us to get over those things.
I love to use the example of what you're describing for me anyway, Crystalline, is expectations. And it's always interesting to me that we expect that we'll go through life and not be injured by anybody. Of course, that's just ludicrous. Of course we will be injured because we're all just human and we're going to say something or do something inadvertently that comes out just exactly the wrong way or is perceived just exactly the wrong way. It's not what we intended at all, but the perception was in that other person, and it's probably based on some other hurt they had long ago, and it pushed some button that you didn't even know was there. And, our human relationships are just rife with landmines like this, and we stumble into these difficulties through no fault of our own and sometimes directly through fault of our own. But so what? What matters most is when the injury becomes more important than the relationship, which is eternal, now you're making the injury eternal.
Right.
And the relationship temporal.
I come from a fairly sarcastic witted family, and wit or sarcasm is something that reached the level of an art when I was living in boarding school with other kids, and so I frequently do or say things that I mean in jest, completely in jest, that can sometimes really hurt somebody's feelings. And I might be totally unaware of it. And I really appreciate it when people confront me and say, when you did that, that really hurt my feelings, or that was really painful or thoughtless. And then they give me an opportunity to make amends. But think about how much courage it takes for people to confront someone when they've been hurt and to work things out. I mean, so many of the times we just carry that hurt away, and it grows into a huge, insurmountable obstacle to relationship. And
I think there's a reason why people do that, why they run away and lick their wounds. It's because they're wounded and they're afraid of being wounded again. And if I say to you, wow, why did you say that? And you come back and say why you said it, and that hurts me even more or something, I think that's why people do that. They're afraid they're going to be hurt again. And so they would rather just run off and lick their wounds. And you're right. It takes a lot of courage to confront somebody and say, that hurt me. And it takes a lot of courage to hear that and not get angry about it and say, well, that's your problem. And I think this is what's at the heart. This is what keeps community from happening oftentimes. Somebody has to be willing to say, that hurt me, and someone has to be willing to hear that and say, I'm sorry that hurt you. I didn't mean to hurt you.
I need to know how we're doing on time here.
Well, we've got 6 minutes on.
Oh, okay, good. That's fine. Go ahead, Crystal. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that many of us have experienced community or have experienced families or places where we can be accepted for who we are, where there is a deep level of love and tolerance and spirituality, and where we are forgiven for those inadvertent things that we do, or where mercy, where really it's a mercy-dominated environment.
where sort of no matter what you do, you're going to be loved and accepted and forgiven. But I don't think that that is necessarily a universal experience on this planet. I mean, I think we tend to, most of us tend to come from places where that isn't something that's a common experience,
yeah,
but it's something we all long for.
I agree, because I think that people who have experienced true community and people who haven't, there's a difference between, when someone has experienced that, it really affects them, I think, ultimately on a deep level. I think it tends to shift the way that they, you know, the direction of their lives in some way, in some fundamental way. And when I talk to people who haven't had that experience, you know, I feel bad for them because there's, you can tell that there's something missing in their lives, you know.
Right. And, you know, some of us get it in our family of origin. Some of us get it in our extended, you know, the family that we've created for ourselves in our little inner circle community. Some people do get that from our church or our spiritual communities. But some people don't have any of that. And when they've come to Urantia events in the past, in some cases they've experienced them as more of an academic experience or more of an intellectual experience. I personally never had that experience at Urantia events. I always found them to be very open, that there were many opportunities for me to have very intimate spiritual and emotional connections as well. But I also came out of a background where being really open emotionally was the norm. And so I think my expectations were that I was going to get along with people and that they were going to like me. And I didn't expect people to hate me. And sometimes I've been surprised by that. But in general, I think that most of us really want to have that experience. Anyway, I'm going to let you go and let you guys, you know, end the show. But I want to thank you for asking me to call in.
Hey, sweetheart. It was so good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
You too.
Froggy and all.
Thank you. Love you guys.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was our good friend, Crystal and Deke Larson. And I'm just, and you know, Paula, as I said before, I've been a Scott Peck groupie since I was in high school, actually. He wrote another really interesting book, by the way. I wish the guy was still alive. He would have been a great guest. He wrote another really interesting book called People of the Lie, which is a book about evil, which is a very interesting book. I mean, so many, well, actually, what he talks about in that book is more what the Urantia book would call iniquity. But he's just such a fascinating person. He was just, I mean, so much of what he said, I thought was so consistent with what we know to be true. You know, from the Urantia book. So anything he's involved with, basically, I can't say much bad about it. So,
you know, everybody who reads M. Scott Peck always mentions People of the Lie as being a very, very good book. And
well, people either love it or hate it. I thought it was his best book, actually. I thought it was, of course, you know, me being into controversy, I liked it because it was the most controversial book that he wrote. But it was so interesting. I mean, it was just, the things he said in there were just so fascinating. But, you know, he was just a really great guy, and I really, it's too bad that he's not with us anymore, but I think that, I'm sure he's probably already teaching up there on the Mansion Worlds.
yeah, I'm sure he is. God bless him. And so we're out of time, but let's just take a minute to thank our dear friend Charlie Fox. Charlie was on the board for a while. Charlie, it was so great to have you on, and really appreciate it, and I appreciate your sharing your spiritual insights with us. And maybe, Andre, you can tell us really quick about what's coming up next week.
Oh, I'm very, very excited about what's coming up next week. But next week we're going to have another British guest, Michael Henderson, who actually was at the Parliament of World Religions, said he met some of the Urantia folks down there, up there. And he wrote a book called No Enemy to Conquer, Forgiveness in an Unforgiving World. So I really look forward to that, and it should be a great show, and I think he'll be able to be with us for the whole 2 hours. So he's not a Urantia book reader. This is another outside-of-the-box guest, and I just really look forward to that. It should be a great show.
Yeah, we're going to love it. And thanks, Andre, for your stalwart friendship and your efforts with these shows. It's always appreciated, my friend. You do a great job.
Well, thank you so much, Paula. And we love everybody, and we will be back next week. So hugs, blessings, warm fuzzies, the whole thing. We'll see you next week.
All right.
Bye. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.